Hey guys, it's Emma
and Shannon,
and welcome back to our podcast, She's an Engineer.
Thanks for tuning in this week, and happy 4th of July.
Woo!
Woo! In this episode, we're going to talk about the women behind the American Revolution and maybe some lesser known stories or efforts that women played in the Revolutionary War. So diving into some background on the Revolutionary War, relations between the 13 colonies and Great Britain worsened after the end of the Seven Years' War, also known as the French and Indian War, and this spanned from 1756 to 1763. The aftermath of the Seven Years' War brought new territories under the power of the crown, but it also plunged the British government deep into debt. And the British Parliament enacted a series of measures to increase tax revenue from the colonies. Attempts by the British government to raise revenue by taxing the colonies included the Stamp Act, the Townshends Act, and the Tea Act. The taxes were met with heated protest among many of the colonies because they resented their lack of representation in Parliament and demanded the same rights as the other British citizens. Eventually, colonial resistance led to violence in 1770 when the British soldiers opened fire on a mob of colonists, killing five men in what was known as the Boston Massacre. After December 1773, when a band of Bostonians altered their appearance to hide their identity, boarded British ships and dumped 342 chests of tea into the Boston Harbor, which we all know as the Boston Tea Party. And that outraged the Parliament and caused them to pass a series of measures, also known as the Intolerable Acts, designed to reassert imperial authority in Massachusetts. All of the fighting between the British and the colonies caused the creation of the First Continental Congress. And the First Continental Congress was composed of delegates from the colonies met in 1774 in reaction to the Intolerable Acts. In 1775, the Second Continental Congress convened after the Revolutionary War already began. And in 1776, it took the monumentous step of declaring America's independence from Britain. 5 years later, the Congress ratified the first national constitution, the Articles of Confederation, under which the country would be governed until 1789, when it was replaced by the U.S. Constitution. And through all of the research that I compiled for this episode, it's noted that the war would have not been as successful if it did not have the support of both the male and female supporters.
Yeah, so a lot of things that we learn, I think, in elementary school, middle school, and high school mostly has to do with many of the male contributions, like going into war and, you know, like assembling the army and doing those things. But actually, women, American women, played a huge role in the American Revolution. So the significance of the contributions made by American women became increasingly apparent as the colonies struggled for their independence. The war gave some women the opportunity to demonstrate their capacity to assume responsibilities that were previously regarded as male responsibilities. So women took charge of the businesses and the farms, defended their homes and neighborhoods, they gathered intelligence for the patriots, they served as maids and cooks for the Continental Army, and some others were also nurses and even soldiers on the battlefields, which is not something you hear a lot about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've also spoken a little bit about these types of changes that happen during wartime when male responsibilities become female responsibilities in previous episodes, where we also talked about women's responsibilities in the world wars as well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, ordinary domestic behaviors became charged with political significance as women confronted the revolution as a war that permeated all aspects of political, civil, and domestic life. So support was expressed through traditional female roles, the home, in the domestic economy, and their husbands' or their fathers' businesses. So there was a movement, the homespun movement, was basically like a protest or a form of protest that promoted American industry, simplicity, and democracy as opposed to British luxury and corruption. So in 1767, which was shortly after Parliament passed the Townshend Act, which increased the duties or like the taxes, the import taxes on manufactured goods, the colonies passed non-importation resolutions. So instead of purchasing clothing that were made of imported British materials, Patriot women relied on their own resources, which included homespun, which was a plain weave cloth made at home. And then during the Revolution, buying American products became a patriotic gesture, and housewives used their purchasing power to support the Patriot cause by refusing to buy British goods for use in their homes. Also, the tea boycott was a relatively mild way for some women to support the Patriot War effort by refusing to buy British tea.
Mm-hmm.
And although the Boston Tea Party of 1773 is the most well-known or widely recognized protest against British tea, for years prior to that, Patriot women had actually been refusing to consume British tea as a political statement. So, like, if they're not going to buy it, then the British have, like, no authority to say, like, hey, like, you have to pay these taxes as, like, a form of protest by just, like, Americans.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really cool that American women started doing that even prior to the Boston Tea Party. It was already a movement to start making goods at home, less taxes, and it, like, kind of brings a sense of community and industry to the U.S., which is pretty cool, or the colonies at the time.
Right, and also eventually relying on, like, the natural resources that we have in America as opposed to imported goods, which costs more to import. And obviously there were taxes, more taxes that they had to pay on it because of the transportation costs and because just, like, of the British taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is definitely something I think, like, American children or just children in general need to learn in school. Like, I feel like in school, from what I remember, you only talk about, like, the big events, like the Boston Tea Party, but you never hear about the little things that happened that, like, also were probably major, like, huge contributions actually to the movement. Because I feel like over the years of women not purchasing the tea, or American women, Patriot women not purchasing British tea or other goods, definitely affects the bottom line more than just one big event.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. Okay, so going on to talking a little bit more about the homespun movement. So in addition to boycotting British textiles or materials, the homespun movement served the Continental Army by producing clothing, blankets, and materials for the soldiers. So women put their skills to use and supported the armies in a variety of important ways. So some sewed uniforms, clothes, and blankets for soldiers. Some made bullets as well as rolled and packed cartridges. And Mary Draper also aided Continental soldiers by providing food, such as freshly baked bread and basic provisions, whenever they passed through her area of Massachusetts. And then also some women who stayed home while their husbands or fathers went to war, they ended up managing the harvesting and selling of crops. They maintained and promoted business inventory and sales, and also coordinated labor and budgets. So they had a big role also at home for, like, maintaining the economy and maintaining, you know, all of the resources that were needed to fund or to feed or clothe the army.
Mm-hmm. Along with that, many women's organizations were formed to support the war effort. and women help the Patriots through organizations, for example, such as the Ladies Association in Philadelphia, which recognized the capacity of every woman to contribute to the war effort. The Women of Philadelphia collected funds to assist in the war effort, which Martha Washington took directly to her husband, General George Washington. Other states followed the example set by founders Esther Day Burt Reed and Sarah Franklin Batch, daughter of Benjamin Franklin. The Ladies Association of Philadelphia, established in 1780, raised over $7,000 for the Continental Army, which is approximately $300,000 in today's currency. And then these funds were given to the Army to purchase materials to make clothes and blankets for the soldiers.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was also common for women and children to follow the army. They were also known as camp followers, and each woman had their own motivations for following the army. So most were wives, daughters, or mothers of the male soldiers and wanted to stay close to their loved ones. Others did so in order to provide for themselves. They looked for food and protection because they were no longer able to support themselves financially after their men left for war. So as a camp follower, a woman was paid a small wage and was supplied with a half ration of food for herself, and their duties consisted primarily of cooking, mending, laundry, childcare, and or nursing. And as wives of the common soldier often followed the Continental Army, the wives of the general officers also did so. So General Henry Knox, the Continental Army's artillery commander, married popular Bostonian Lucy Flucker, who was the daughter of Bostonian loyalists. And once she and Henry were married, all ties between her and her family were cut. So Henry and Lucy were devoted to one another, and she would join him whenever she could while he was on campaign. She endured the bitter encampment at Valley Forge, and she also became friends with the wife of General Nathaniel Greene, Kitty. George Washington's wife, Martha Custis, also spent every winter with her husband wherever the army was camped. She set up a sewing circle of officers' wives, which included Kitty Greene and Lucy Knox, and she became indispensable as a comfort to Washington and his men.
Mm-hmm. That's just such a commitment to follow your husband while he's on campaign moving around in the army.
I know.
Awesome. And then moving to the battlefront, I have a few stories to share here. So allegedly there was a female Paul Revere and 16-year-old Sybil Luddington. The female Paul Revere made her ride on April 26, 1777 during a heavy rainstorm, traveling 40 miles and avoiding capture. And she had learned that the British were planning to attack a town in Connecticut and the location of the stockpile of provisions for the Continental Army. Her father, Henry, was a colonel in the militia in command of 400 men, and Luddington spurred her horse, prodding him with a stick to raise the alarm in the Putnam County, New York. The British, however, were successful on their raid in the Connecticut town of Danbury, but because of Luddington's alarm, the Patriots encountered the British outside of the city in nearby Ridgefield, Connecticut, and was successful in driving them back to Long Island. Some women were caught inadvertently in the battle. So as Emma mentioned, there were some camp followers, and some of those camp followers would help some of these women would help their husbands and fathers on the cannon crews, and they would do so by hauling water in barrels down to the cannons for cleaning or for the crew members to drink on hot days. And sometimes these women were just flung into the vortex of battle, such as the case of Mary Ludwig Hayes, better known as Molly Pitcher. And she earned fame at the Battle of Monmouth in 1778. Hayes had brought soldiers water from a local well to quench their thirst on an extremely hot and humid day when her husband fell in battle. And after her husband fell, Mary operated his cannon firing at the oncoming British. She just took over his cannon and started firing.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. In a similar vein, Margaret Corbin was severely wounded during the British assault on Fort Washington in November 1776 and left dead alongside her husband, also an artillery man, until she was attended by a physician. She lived, although her wounds left her permanently disabled, and history recalls her as the first American female to receive a soldier's lifetime pension after the war. There are also cases of women who chose to actively join the army as fighting soldiers. One of the most famous of these women was Deborah Sampson. Originally from Massachusetts, she disguised herself as a man in order to fight in the Continental Army. Serving under the alias of her deceased brother, she fought with the Light Infantry Company of the 4th Massachusetts Regiment. She was wounded in action in Tarrytown, New York, with two bullets in her thigh and a gash in her forehead. And I think she had become wounded in a few different battles, but she really didn't want her identity as a female to be revealed. So she treated her head wound herself and left the field hospital unnoticed. She was able to extract one of the bullets from her thigh with a knife. Eventually, her identity was revealed during the summer of 1783 when she contracted a fever while on duty in Philadelphia. After the Treaty of Paris, she was given an honorable discharge from the army, and she went on to marry and have three children, settling back down in Massachusetts. To make ends meet, she often gave public lectures about her wartime service, and by the time she died in 1827, she was collecting minimal pensions from her service for Massachusetts and the federal government. And I know this is just one story about Deborah Sampson, but I believe there are many other women who disguised themselves as men and decided to join the army to fight for the independence of the U.S.
Very brave and honorable, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Women also played a big role in the political sphere. So a well-known woman in the political sphere was Abigail Adams. So as the Second Continental Congress was formed and debated the Declaration of Independence, Abigail Adams began the argument in her letters to her husband, who was John Adams, that the creation of a new form of government was a chance to make the legal status of women equal to that of men. So progressive, I guess, beyond her years, because mm-hmm. women didn't gain, I guess, equal status until the 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
The future First Lady wrote in part, "I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Which she mm-hmm. did, I guess, predict what would happen in the future.
Yeah.
Because they weren't able to, I guess, make women as equal as men in the Declaration of Independence. And Adams' articulation on behalf of the ladies was indeed revolutionary and has become one of the most famous statements on behalf of early American women's rights.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's worth noting that both Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, and Martha Washington, George Washington's wife, were both really strong, independent, and supportive women. And that, like, allowed their husbands to also go on and, like, become president because they both mm-hmm. were very, very supportive wives and had a lot of independence and, like, free thought.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So after the war was over, women often became historians because they had a lot of diaries and letters from the wartime, if they were at home and like writing all of these throughout the war. So whether through publishing their own stories or the stories of others, there were several women who wrote compelling historical narratives about the war. In 1805, Mercy Otis Warren published The History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution. In 1827, Anne Darragh, daughter of American spy Lydia, published a story of her mother's work. Deborah Sampson, as we mentioned earlier, the woman who disguised herself as her deceased brother in order to fight in the army, ended up giving public lectures about her time as a Continental soldier. And by providing their dynamic and diverse narrative to the wealth of other male narratives, they gave modern historians a richer understanding of a history nearly 250 years old. And then there was one more poet and writer that I wanted to mention. Phyllis Wheatley was an enslaved African American living in Boston, and she took up the pen and paper and wrote poetry. And she became one of the first female African American to become published. And her collection in 1773 was a collection of poems on various subjects, religious and moral, which was popular on both sides of the Atlantic. And her poems focus on patriotism and human virtues. She even wrote a poem about George Washington, which was called To His Excellency George Washington in 1775, which she personally read to him at his Cambridge headquarters in 76. And her visit was a result of an invitation from Washington. Wheatley obtained her freedom in 1778. And overall, truly without the efforts of many of these women, and a lot of them unknown, unnamed women, the efforts of the Continental Army would be for naught, as they wouldn't have the support to succeed. And as Abigail Adams once said, we need to remember the ladies.
Yes. So I hope you guys learned a lot. I thought this was really interesting. But I hope you learned a lot about the women that were a huge part of the American Revolution and America's success in independence. And on the 4th of July, remember the ladies for sure.
Yeah.
If you guys have any other topics like the history of women in a specific subject that you want us to talk about, feel free to reach out to us or put it as a comment or answer to our question that we'll put below. So we hope you guys have a good 4th of July, and thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.